In 2009, Vicki and Daryl Gatwood of St. Anne, Illinois, made quite a discovery. They were renovating an abandoned house. It was in desperate shape. The grass was overgrown, the floors sunken, and a tree had fallen and torn a hole in the roof. As they looked around, they came upon stacks of papers, musical manuscripts, letters, photos, diary fragments, and they kept seeing one name over and over, Florence Price. Join us this hour as we present Gathering the Pieces, the Florence Price Legacy. Price was born in 1887 in Arkansas. She would become the first Black woman to have her music played by a major American orchestra. She had a successful musical career, yet faded into the background after her death. The discovery of her previously unknown works has now brought her music to the foreground as musicians across the country try to bring it to life. In this hour, we'll hear from the archivists in Arkansas who went to Illinois to acquire the Florence Price papers.
Gives me goosebumps right now, just talking about it.
As well as the musicians dedicated to interpreting what's on the manuscripts and having her lost work performed and shared.
My guiding light was, well, what would Florence do?
And KUAR makes its own Florence Price discovery, a documentary the station made in 1994 featuring rare interviews with Price's music students and family friends. It was found on an old cassette tape. This is Gathering the Pieces, the Florence Price Legacy. I'm Karen Trigo Stewart. Stay with us. First, we ask the question, who was Florence Price? To give us some insight, we turn to Linda Holzer, a concert pianist and music professor at UA Little Rock and a scholar of Florence Price. Linda Holzer, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Karen.
So tell us, how did Price's musical career develop?
Well, Florence Price was born and raised right here in Little Rock, and she was a child prodigy. It's so rare to encounter a child prodigy. There are good music students, and then there are prodigies. She was exceptional. And we shouldn't be surprised about this, given that her father was a medical professional, a dentist, and he was also a visual artist, a painter. And her mother was a talented pianist herself. And so Florence Price grew up surrounded by an emphasis on the beauty of art and the importance of education.
And speaking of education, Price would go on to attend the prestigious New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. So she marries Thomas Price, a lawyer, and she moves back to Little Rock. And they end up leaving Arkansas and going to Chicago. What happened and how did things play out for Florence Price?
It has been documented that the Price family had fled Arkansas in 1927 when deteriorating race relations in the South made life extremely difficult for Black citizens, most specifically the horrifying lynchings in 1926 and 1927. They arrived in Chicago and got settled and found jobs, and they enrolled their daughters in school, two daughters, and then the stock market crashed in 1929, and the Great Depression hit. People were really struggling to survive, people in all fields, but especially Thomas Price, as an African-American lawyer, found that he couldn't find work as a lawyer. Florence Price was very creative and hustled, and she found work in teaching and organ performance and, I believe, also church music. But unfortunately, her husband became bitter and abusive, and he took out his anger at being unemployed on his family and very difficult circumstances. The Price marriage ended. Now, some people faced with that challenge would not find that that was an impetus for great creativity. But for Florence Price, even though she was the single mother of two children, the same month as her divorce was finalized, January of 1931, that's when Florence Price began work on the music that would become Symphony No. 1 in E minor. And that's something I find fascinating and quite a testament to the strength of this woman composer.
And so that's the piece that eventually was given its world premiere by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Frederick Stock. What made Stock want to take a chance on her?
Well, Frederick Stock was quite sympathetic to new American composers. And Stock was criticized for this because there are always those who worship the past and feel that the only music worth playing is by legendary composers, not living composers. But Stock held his ground. And even though some people said, well, you're putting too many novelties on the CSO concert programs, he was firmly committed to his ideal of promoting new music.
So if Price was so successful during her lifetime, why does it seem like she was forgotten so quickly after her death in 1953?
Well, you know, racism and sexism limited certain kinds of professional opportunities for her. I'd say there's an equation for success as a composer. The composer has to have talent and drive. Price had that unquestionably. But another part of the equation is getting published. And that makes it easier to get your works performed in concert and to go on to have commercial recordings and broadcasts of your music. In other words, to have your music live on after you. Most of her concert works, those were still in manuscript form at the time of her death. In other words, unpublished. The exciting thing is, now, thanks to determined scholars and performers, finally, we have access to rediscovered manuscripts that are being published, and that means they're getting performed and recorded.
That was Linda Holzer, a Price scholar and professor of music at UA Little Rock. Holzer recently played an instrumental role in having Florence Price honored posthumously by the Arkansas State Music Teachers Association. The association once denied Price entry because of her race. Here's a portion of Price's Symphony No. 1 in E minor, the music that made her the first African-American woman to have her music played by a major American orchestra. To get some more insight into who Florence Price was, let's bring her voice to life. These words are from a letter she wrote in 1943 to the conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, as performed by writer, publisher, and presidential diarist Janice Kearney. In this letter, Florence Price asks the conductor to please consider her work and put aside any assumptions about the type of music a Black woman might write.
To begin with, I have two handicaps, those of sex and race. I am a woman, and I have some Negro blood in my veins. Knowing the worst, then, would you be good enough to hold in check the possible inclination to regard a woman's composition as long on emotionalism but short on virility and thought content until you have examined some of my work? As to the handicap of race, may I relieve you by saying that I neither expect nor ask any concession on that score? I should like to be judged on merit alone, the greatest trouble having been to get conductors who know nothing of my work to even consent to examine a score. Having been born in the South and having spent most of my childhood there, I believe I can truthfully say that I understand the real Negro music. In some of my work, I make use of the idiom undiluted. At other times, it merely flavors my themes. And at still other times, thoughts come in the garb of the other side of my mixed racial background. I have tried for practical purposes to cultivate and preserve a facility of expression in both idioms, although I have unwavering and compelling faith that a national music, very beautiful and very American, can come from the melting pot, just as the nation itself has done. Will you examine my scores?
You're listening to Gathering the Pieces, the Florence Price Legacy, here on 89.1 KUAR. More information about the program can be found at pricelegacy.kuar.org. Archivists Tim Nutt and Tom Dillard were working at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville in 2009 when a call came in about papers that belonged to Florence Price being found in an abandoned house in St. Anne, Illinois. So they traveled there, wondering what they would find. Linda and Daryl Gatwood were the owners renovating the old property, and it turned out the house was once Price's summer home. We sat down with Dillard and Nutt, who told us the story of seeing the collection for the first time. Here's Tim Nutt.
Both Tom and I were really amazed at the materials that were in that collection. But at that time, even though we were amazed by it, we didn't really know the full extent of exactly what was in that collection and how significant that find would be later on.
It's really remarkable that this house had been abandoned for years and years and years. When the Gatwoods bought the house in their first venture into the home, It was in rough condition, but it had not been vandalized at that point. But by the time they bought the land, the houses and such, and got in touch with us and we can get up there, vandals had broken into the house. They stole her grand piano, which she used to do her compositions, and there's many pictures of her at her piano in that room. So the house was in really desperate, desperate condition, made worse by these vandals who got in there. They took her compositions out of file cabinets. There were still one or more file cabinets in the room with her stuff in the cabinets. And that's probably why they survived, is they were enclosed within a metal filing cabinet. But by the time the Gatwoods got back again, those records had been strewn all over the place. So it's a miracle that they didn't just shovel all this stuff into a dumpster and go on about their lives, but they didn't. They looked at it. And they were both intelligent people. They realized that there was something here that probably should be looked at. It is really remarkable that we were able to get up there and get this collection, which had come so close to being lost. I mean, it was right on the verge of being lost.
The papers were there in their dining room. And I remember sitting down and pulling out composition after composition and photograph after photograph from this collection and just being amazed and looking at Tom and just being really shocked that we're actually holding this photograph of Scipio Jones, who was a famed African-American attorney from Little Rock. And, you know, this photograph that we have never seen in all of our years in Arkansas history studies, seeing this photograph and seeing it in the collection and then just letter after letter. And it's just a really amazing it gives me goosebumps right now just talking about it. It was really a fulfilling moment in my career.
Florence Price's husband, Thomas Price, was a Little Rock lawyer, and he was a legal partner of Scipio A. Jones. And that explains why that signed original portrait of Scipio A. Jones was in her papers. They knew each other very, very well. It is tragic that in 1927, there was an attack on the black community in Little Rock following a lynching. And the black community of Little Rock was horrified by this. And many people who could afford left Little Rock. Many black professionals and others who could afford it left Little Rock and went north. And it was at this time that Thomas and Florence Price moved to Chicago. So it's really tragic that Arkansas lost this family, this really remarkable family. 1927 was an awful time for black people in Arkansas, so it's not surprising that they went north.
So the collection was found, and her contributions are recognized as musicians across the country become passionate about the music and want to reconstruct her music. What would you like to see happen now? Tim?
I'm hoping at some point that the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra here in Little Rock will perform Florence Price. There are talks for maybe getting together funds to erect a statue for her, and I think that would be a fitting memorial to her as well.
I would like to see more people in the state develop an interest in systematically preserving records. If the Florence Price collection taught us nothing else, it at least taught us that you can't always expect your children to do the right thing by your papers. The offspring of famous people don't necessarily understand that the records could have significance. So I'm hopeful that people will, over time, use the Florence Price experience as a reminder that fate's not always going to deliver a collection into an archives. We need to take action to make sure they're saved.
Those were the voices of Tim Nutt and Tom Dillard, who traveled to the abandoned house in Illinois in 2009, where stacks of papers belonging to Florence Price were uncovered. You can see pictures of the old dilapidated house at pricelegacy.kuar.org. Next, musical detectives. We hear from three musicians who have been dedicated to interpreting Price's manuscripts and reconstructing her music. But first, we travel to downtown Little Rock, to the newly renovated Robinson Center, where there's now an atrium space dedicated to Florence Price. It's just outside the ballroom, named for African-American composer William Grant Still. Here's Scott Carter, a historian for the city.
Still and she grew up as friends in Little Rock. He was a few years older than her, but their families knew each other, and they remained friends throughout their careers. I think she would be pleased to share space right next to his space, and vice versa.
In 2010, the Center for Black Music Research in Chicago commissioned Trevor Weston, a music professor at Drew University, to reconstruct the long-lost Concerto in One movement. We spoke with Weston, who says when he was first approached by the center, he was familiar with Florence Price because of classes he'd taken in African-American music history, but didn't know her music in great detail.
One of the benefits and, I think, almost thrills of working on this project was becoming so kind of intimately connected to her music, because I had to use scores in her own hand, kind of figure out how to interpret her handwriting and what she meant and what she maybe implied as far as the orchestration. And then I also look back at letters that Florence Price wrote or any specific information about her personality. And she was a very strong person. I mean, she left the South, went to Boston. She was biracial, but decided to identify herself as being African American. And I think she left her husband because she wanted to devote her life to writing music, which didn't seem possible in that relationship. So what that told me was that this was a very strong person. And a strong person, in my mind, would orchestrate their music with very strong gestures. So that was very helpful.
So you're doing all this research to try to stay true to who Florence Price was. I was talking to a classical musician in New York as part of producing this program, and she told me that you were constantly asking yourself, what would Florence do?
What would Florence do? Exactly, that's right. So, when I first, said yes to this, I thought, oh, I've studied orchestration, I've made arrangements for orchestra. But then I realized the essence of this wasn't to make Trevor Weston's orchestration of Florence Price's music. It's to study and imagine Florence Price. And I think at first it was daunting, but the more I felt like I got to know her, and that might sound strange, but I think in poetry, in visual art, and in creative writing, you get to know this kind of the essence of a person. So after playing through her music and getting a sense of who she was, it made it easier to make decisions. So yes, my guiding light was, well, what would Florence do? And that helped.
So you finished reconstructing the piece. How'd you feel about it when it was done?
Reconstructing it and sending off the parts for all the instruments and the score wasn't the final step. At that time, the leading Price scholar Ray Linda Brown was present for the kind of re-premiere or the premiere of this reconstruction. And she knew Florence and knew her music very well. So as far as I was concerned, until Ray Linda Brown said that it sounded like Florence, I wasn't sure if it was successful, and she did.
We do want to note that Florence Price scholar Ray Linda Brown, who Weston mentioned, passed away in August of last year from cancer. We'll be posting a video of a smiling Brown being interviewed after the discovery of Price's long-lost music. You can find that at pricelegacy.kuar.org. You're listening to Gathering the Pieces, the Florence Price Legacy, here on 89.1 KUAR. Trevor, I was reading an article in the New York Times from July of 2016 with a headline, "For Black Lives Matter, Classical Music Steps In." And it talks about the orchestral concert in New York that was put on to benefit the Black Lives Matter movement. That concert featured the Concerto in One movement, the piece that you reconstructed. How do you think Florence Price fits into the Black Lives Matter movement today?
Well, I have a couple ideas. I lived in Charleston, South Carolina for 9 years, and while I was there, I wrote a short paper on black classical musicians working in Charleston between 1900 and 1930. And I spoke with the widow of the last director of the Avery Normal School, which was an African-American normal school in Charleston. And she told me that when she was a kid, she was African-American, she was practicing a violin, and the postman came to the door and asked her mother, why are you wasting your money, you know, teaching violin to your girl? And her mother said, because we can, because we're free. And I got from that sense that, you know, participating in classical music was a sign of freedom and independence, which might sound strange in the 21st century, but considering African Americans are often kind of limited to a specific type of individual or an individual who excels in certain things and not other things, I think performing music by black classical musicians or their black classical composers is a way to kind of show that our contributions matter, as it were. So in that way, I think that Florence Price is definitely connected to this basic idea of acknowledgement. Your life, your contributions matter.
That was Trevor Weston. The Center for Black Music Research in Chicago commissioned him to reconstruct the long-lost Concerto in One movement. Other pieces found in the abandoned house that was once Florence Price's summer home include two violin concertos. Violinist Urgene Kong with the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville premiered Price's Violin Concerto No. 2 when the University of Arkansas held a 3-day celebration of Florence Price in February of this year. She spoke with Kyle Kellums of NPR member station KUAF in Fayetteville, and here's a portion of their conversation.
Is it intimidating, liberating, or somewhere in the middle to do the first recording of somebody's work decades after it's written?
Intimidating, exciting, I would say. For me, I've realized that so many of the projects that I undertake, I never have to ask myself the question, can I do this? It's not because the projects previously were so manageable or easy or anything like that, but it's somehow something of this magnitude and of this newness seems to demand that question of, am I the right person to do this and am I capable? Because I want to make sure it's done with integrity and that it's done well. And it was daunting. To be honest with you, my first few answers, because I asked myself that same question probably daily for quite a bit to see if the answers would change, was actually no. I did not think that I was the right person. I still don't know if I'm the right person, of course, but I am very happy to have undergone it and to have followed through and to have had the serendipitous moments that made this somehow come together.
When it comes to symphonies, Price wrote or sketched a total of 4. The first and third have been published and recorded. The second remains somewhat of a mystery, and the fourth will receive its premiere by the Fort Smith Symphony Orchestra next weekend. We called music director John Jetter, who explained it's all part of a larger project to perform and record all 4 symphonies.
It will be the first complete set of her symphonies, and we will be recording that on the Naxos label. And Naxos International is the largest classical music label in the world. So they have a terrific distribution, and they have a huge interest in projects like this.
So how did you go about constructing the 4th symphony that will premiere next weekend?
So we took the original score and sent it to 2 wonderful composers, copyists, and a performing edition was created off of her original manuscript of the 4th symphony. And it's beautifully written. It's all complete. And that's what we're going to be performing. And it'll be the first time that that piece has ever been performed live. So we're very excited about it. There are also a number of pages of music that sustained quite a bit of water damage. And I believe the university is slowly going through the process of looking through all that to see what else we can find. Among other things, the 2nd symphony. That is kind of an interesting process that we still have to go through. Since we are supposed to be recording all 4 symphonies, we need to find the 2nd symphony. And so far, all we have is the first 12 or so completed pages of that symphony. So this is sort of a musical detective story that's evolving. And it's a real exciting thing.
You're listening to Gathering the Pieces, the Florence Price Legacy, here on 89.1 KUAR. More information about the program can be found at pricelegacy.kuar.org. Here at KUAR, we recently made a Florence Price discovery of our own in the form of an old cassette tape. It was a documentary produced by the station in 1994, and it features rare interviews with Price's music students and family friends. It was produced by musicologist Ernest Lamb in collaboration with the late Ben Fry, longtime general manager of KUAR and KLRE Classical 90.5. The show was called From Spiritual to Symphony, and it was produced long before Price's works were found in the abandoned home and a rediscovery of her life and work occurred. But Ernest Lamb, who played in the Arkansas Symphony, and Ben Fry decided it was important to honor her and tell her story. Thanks for joining us for Gathering the Pieces, the Florence Price Legacy. I'm Karen Trigo Stewart. This program was brought to you from the KUAR studios at UA Little Rock. A special thanks to Linda Holzer, whose passion for the story of Florence Price helped lead to the making of this program. She also played some of the music you heard. Also to Deborah Baldwin of the Center for Arkansas History and Culture, who digitized the 1994 KUAR documentary on Price after it was found on an old cassette tape. And J. Bradley Minnick, who helped produce this show. For more information about this program, visit pricelegacy.kuar.org. And now, in the second half hour of this program, we bring you From Spiritual to Symphony.
The year, 1933. The place, the Chicago Century of Progress Exhibition. The event, a performance of a new symphony by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Maestro Frederick Stock. It would be the first time that any major orchestra performed a work by a Black woman composer. How appropriate that this performance should take place during an exhibition of progress, for it's progress indeed that anyone was able to overcome the burdens imposed by the race, gender, and social conventions of America at that time. I am Ernest Martin Lamb. Join us for a musical discovery as we make the journey from spiritual to symphony, a portrait of Florence Smith Price.
From Spiritual to Symphony, is made possible by a grant from the Arkansas Arts Council.
By the time Florence Smith was born in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1888, the promises of the Reconstruction period were forgotten. The hopes and aspirations of America's newly freed slaves had been replaced with fear and desperation as they witnessed the birth of Jim Crow and his subsequent reign of violence and segregation. Despite the collapse of Reconstruction and the rise of racial segregation and violence in towns and cities across the nation, Little Rock was still considered one of the most enlightened communities in the South, a good place for coloreds. As the antebellum distinction between field hand and house servants changed, a new caste system emerged. A cultural elite arose whose membership requirements were education, wealth, and respectability. These aristocrats of color cultivated exquisite manners, proper language, and good form in receiving guests. Their cultural lives centered around musical and literary activities and the black institutions of higher learning. Another black composer, William Grant Still, who lived in Little Rock, described the community of his time.
Our group was well educated, lived in comfortable homes, usually in racially mixed neighborhoods, traveled extensively, and entertained regularly. William Grant Still.
The lifeblood of the African-American community in Little Rock was 9th Street, with its rows of office buildings, nightclubs, drugstores, and beauty salons. At its heart was Bethel AME Church and the Mosaic Templars Building of America, which satisfied both the worldly and otherworldly needs of Little Rock's African-Americans. Two sisters, Edith Flakes and Judith Finn, both former piano students of Mrs. Price, remember the 9th Street of their youth.
The doctors had their offices there, and they had an auditorium there where they would have dances. Many of the big bands would come to Little Rock, Cab Calloway, Louis Armstrong, a lot of them.
9th Street was a busy, busy street on every corner. People who were shopping on Main Street, especially men, and people who came from the Rock Island Station in the East End would walk to Main Street and stay a while. Then they would continue around their corner, 9th and Main, on down to 9th and Arch. And they would congregate there in groups, and they'd always have a lot of fun. But you could hear, not only see people dressed and going about activities, you could hear every once in a while you hear a boom. Somebody was shooting just like they're doing things now, and we would be afraid.
This was the Little Rock of Florence Smith Price, a community where commerce and culture were valued, nurtured, and appreciated, but not without a share of excitement and danger. Florence received her first musical training from her mother, who presented her in a recital of her own compositions at age 4. By 11, her first composition was published. By 14, she was the valedictorian of her graduating class. And by 15, she was a freshman at the New England Conservatory. Despite the fact that the New England Conservatory was one of the few music schools that admitted black students, Florence's mother took added precautions. She arranged an expensive apartment for Florence with a maid and listed her place of birth as Pueblo, Mexico. With a degree in organ as soloist and in piano as a teacher, Florence returned to Arkansas in 1906 to begin her teaching career at the Cotton Plant Arkadelphia Academy. A year later, she began teaching at Shorter College in North Little Rock, but moved again in 1910 to become the chairman of the Department of Music at Clark University in Atlanta. But after only 2 years, Florence returned to Little Rock, this time to marry a promising young attorney, Thomas J. Price. Between raising her two girls and giving music lessons, Florence found the time to write music. In consecutive years, her piano pieces, In the Land of Cotton and Memories of Dixieland, tied for second in Opportunity Magazine's Holston Prize. Mrs. Flakes, after 66 years, has never lost her joy for music. A former piano student of Florence Price, she passes on what she has learned to a new generation of pianists.
I found Mrs. Price to be a very good teacher, very thorough teacher, and she really did give students a very good background.
Her sister, Mrs. Finn, also took lessons from Florence Price. She remembers her teacher's kindly voice, which could still deliver a stern message.
I saw Mr. Price in the home before he went to work. In the morning, he was a lawyer. And I was thinking of so often how softly she would speak to him about leaving home and going down to see about his work. Because I had been in other people's homes when their husbands and wives were talking together. It was much harsher, but she'd say so sweetly what she said to him. And she was stern with that. She meant for him to get out there and find something to do. Lawyers weren't making money then.
Mr. Price was a partner with one of Arkansas's most famous and well-respected lawyers, Scipio Africanus Jones. Together, they successfully argued and won a landmark case in Arkansas, the Elaine Race Riot case of 1919. Though a Southern court system had ruled in favor of a black lawyer and his black clients, who were accused of inciting a riot, liberty and justice for all was just something you said when the flag was raised. 4 years after the famous case, Little Rock's enlightened community had a very different idea of equal justice, a lynching in front of Bethel AME Church on 9th Street. Mrs. Finn remembers what she felt as a little girl when the 1927 incident occurred.
It was like a very scary day, and everybody was in the house. And we lived at 1820 Marshall, and everything was quiet. It seemed like it was a gloomy afternoon. I can always remember that. But whenever there was anything like trouble, our parents kept us inside. But I did hear about the man hanging up there on that corner, which caused many a prominent citizen to pack up and leave. The Cables of Mount Zion, Reverend Cable was pastor. His family went to Cleveland, I believe, Ohio. They got together and seemed like all of them left.
Among those prominent citizens to leave Little Rock in 1927 were the Prices. Like thousands of other African Americans, they left their southern homes and migrated to the great urban centers of the North. Chicago became the new home for Florence and her family. It was already home to Sterling Todd, a former Little Rock student of Mrs. Price, whose orchestra performed regularly at the Savoy Hotel. '30, the stock market crashes and the nation plummets into despair. For a time, Florence wrote jingles for radio commercials and sold many of her beginning student piano pieces to various publishers. But times were still hard. Florence found relief from her financial worries and time to compose in the home of Mrs. Estella Bonds, a church organist. Her daughter, Margaret Bonds, who became a composer and pianist in her own right, talked about her mother's support of the arts in an essay.
My mother had a collector's nose for anything that was artistic. And because she was a true woman of God, she lived the Sermon on the Mount. Her loaves and fish fed a multitude of pianists, singers, violinists, and composers. And those who were not in need of material food came for spiritual food. Margaret Bonds.
By 1931, Price was hard at work on a symphony that would gain her recognition and respect as a serious composer, and secure her place in music history as the first Black woman to have a work performed by a major professional orchestra. In a letter to a friend, Florence wrote about that time.
I finally found it possible to snatch a few precious days in January to write, undisturbed. But when shall I ever be so fortunate again as to break a foot? Florence Price.
In 1932, Florence Price entered two compositions in the Rodman Wanamaker Music Composition Contest, a piano sonata and a symphony. Both compositions won first prize. Her symphony came to the attention of the conductor of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at that time, Frederick Stock. The symphony in E minor was premiered June 15, 1933 at Orchestra Hall, Chicago, and performed again that summer at the World's Fair Century of Progress exhibition when it was broadcast over radio. The press echoed the enthusiastic reception of those Chicago audiences.
A symphony by Florence Price had its first performance on this occasion. It is a faultless work, a work that speaks its own message with restraint and yet with passion. Mrs. Price's symphony is worthy of a place in the regular symphonic repertoire. Eugene Stinson, Chicago Daily News.
Mrs. Price's symphony won the Wanamaker contest, and though we did not hear the other contestants, we can readily understand her success. The symphony is ably, intelligently, interestingly constructed and conceived. There is an abundance of typical coloring and atmosphere. She is not an imitator. Herman DeVries, Chicago Evening American.
Florence, despite her apparent success, still continued to study her craft. She took courses in composition with Carl Busch and Wesley LaViolette at the Chicago Musical College. New works followed, works which established her reputation as an American composer of merit and brought her music to a wider audience. A piano concerto in one movement was given its premiere in Orchestra Hall, June 24, 1934, with Price at the piano. The concerto was an immediate success, and other performances followed, including one with the Chicago's Women's Symphony, this time with Margaret Bonds at the piano. Again, the press was ecstatic.
A nationalist in my attitude toward the arts, it is pleasant for me to record the brilliant success of Florence Price's Piano Concerto as presented by Margaret Bonds and the orchestra. It represents the most successful effort to date to lift the native folk song of the Negro to artistic levels. It is full of fine melodies deriving from this source directly or by imitation. The quasi-symphonic treatment of these ideas shows abundant resource, both harmonic and orchestral. Finally, the piano part is expertly set upon the keyboard and was brilliantly played by Margaret Bonds. Glenn Dillard Gunn, Chicago Herald and Examiner.
The use of the Negro folk idiom as an integral part of classical music was not peculiar to Mrs. Price, nor to William Grant Steele or William Dawson, who had also successfully integrated the Negro folk idiom in their compositions. Bohemian composer Antonin Dvorak, after his visit to the United States, urged American composers to do the same. His Symphony from the New World was an inspiring example for American composers who were searching for a voice to call their own.
Having been born in the South and having spent most of my childhood there, I believe I can truthfully say that I understand the real Negro music. In some of my work, I make use of the idiom undiluted. Again, at other times, it merely flavors my themes. And still at other times, thoughts come in the garb of the other side of my mixed racial background. I have tried, for practical purposes, to cultivate and preserve a facility of expression in both idioms. Florence Price.
The music of Florence Price reflects the duality and the conflict between classical music written in the Western European tradition and classical music written in the African American tradition. Her arrangement of the spiritual My Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord, made famous by the contralto Marian Anderson, clearly reflects her African-American heritage.
In the Lord, in the Lord, my soul's been anchored in the Lord, in the Lord.
anchored in the Lord. My soul's been anchored in the Lord. Before I'd stay in hell one day, my soul's been anchored in the Lord. I'd sing and pray myself away. My soul's been anchored in the Lord, oh Lord. My soul's been anchored in the Lord, oh Lord. God knows my soul's been anchored in the Lord.
Yet her art song, Night, bears no trace of ethnicity. Florence Price returned to Little Rock in 1935 to give a concert of her music. This was the only time that she was to return to Little Rock.
Florence B. Price, pianist and composer, will be featured in a benefit concert at the Dunbar High School at 8:15 tonight under the auspices of the Philander Smith Alumni Association. The program will include a prize-winning sonata by the artist, who has won several prizes for her work, including the Wanamaker Prize of $750 in 1931. Price of admission will be 25 cents for adults and 15 for students and 50 cents for reserved seats. Special reserved seats have been arranged for white persons.
All of Little Rock turned out to hear and sat spellbound throughout the entire performance. By the 1940s, Mrs. Price's reputation as a composer was international. Her works had been performed by major orchestras on both sides of the Atlantic, and her art songs and spiritual arrangements had become part of the repertoire of many world-renowned singers, among them Marian Anderson, Roland Hayes, Blanche Thibault, William Warfield, and Leontine Price. Though Florence Price's music was widely performed during her lifetime, those performances were hard won. Earlier, she had been denied membership in the Arkansas Music Teachers Association because of her race. And even 10 years after the successes of her symphony in E minor and her piano concerto, Florence still found it difficult to get her large works for orchestra performed or published. In a 1943 letter to Serge Koussevitzky, she wrote of her frustrations.
To begin with, I have two handicaps, those of sex and race. I am a woman, and I have some Negro blood in my veins. Knowing the worst, then, would you be good enough to hold in check the possible inclination to regard a woman's composition as long on emotionalism, but short on virility and thought content, until you examine some of my work? As to the handicap of race, may I relieve you by saying that I neither expect nor ask any concession on that score. I should like to be judged on merit alone, the great trouble having been to get conductors who know nothing of my work to even consent to examine a score. Florence Price.
Despite those added burdens of sex and race, Florence continued to compose in every genre except opera. Besides her three symphonies and a piano concerto, she wrote at least two violin concertos, several pieces for piano and organ, numerous songs for chorus and solo voice, chamber music, and piano pieces for beginning students. She composed until her death in the spring of 1953. Earlier that year, her suite of Negro dances was performed by members of the Chicago Symphony on a television pops concert, and plans were made to visit Europe. Marion Ross, whose mother was a lifelong friend of Mrs. Price, talks about that European trip that her mother was to make with Mrs. Price.
My mother was one of these people who dreamed a lot, and she put a lot of stock in interpreting her dreams. And we grew to at least tolerate it, because so many of the things that she said, we watched, you know, come true. Mrs. Price had never been to Europe. And her daughter Florence had always wanted her to have that opportunity. And I'm not so sure now, I don't remember whether it was probably 1953 or 1954, Florence, the daughter, made the arrangements for her to have the European trip and asked Mrs. Price who she would like to have accompany her. And of course, she wanted my mother to go along with her. And once again, it was some of these feelings that my mother had that she really wasn't going any place, and we were all excited about it and did quite a lot to encourage her and kind of push that she get her passport. And I was doing a lot of sewing at the time and made her this wonderful wardrobe, and we were just really excited. The church clubs gave her little handkerchief showers and whatever for the trip. And on the Monday before they were to have sailed from New York, my mother called Chicago, and the daughter said her mother was in the hospital for a checkup. And when my mother hung up, she said, "I don't think so." And she left the next day, went to Chicago. Mrs. Price died that Wednesday, I believe, and they had the funeral. She stayed there for her funeral. I was teaching in South Carolina at the time, and my mother came and spent 2 weeks with me and was not at all disappointed, because she never felt she was going any place anyway.
African-American composer Florence Price died in June 1953 after a brief illness in Chicago. 11 years later, on November 24, 1964, the Chicago Public School System named a school in her memory. As significant as that gesture may be, the memory of the honoree has faded with each passing generation. For Mrs. Price, the only true lasting legacy of a life well spent is more than a building, more than the premieres, more than the awards. It's the lives that were inspired by her spirit and the souls that were moved by her music.
There is real American music, and Mrs. Price is speaking in a language she knows.
Songs to the Dark Virgin was, as Miss Anderson sang it, one of the greatest immediate successes ever won by an American song.
Thinking also of how softly she would speak to him about leaving home and going down to see about his work.
Mrs. Price has achieved what few women of any race are capable of doing when she made her invasion of the symphonic field.
I found Mrs. Price to be a very good teacher, very thorough teacher.
She is not an imitator. Mrs. Price's symphony is worthy of a place in the regular symphonic repertoire.
I guess my major regret is that I didn't know her better and didn't appreciate what she was doing at the time.
Thank you.
From Spiritual to Symphony, a portrait of Florence Smith Price, was written and produced by your host, Ernest Martin Lamb, and directed by Ben Fry. Research assistance was provided by Dr. Barbara Garvey Jackson, Dr. Willard Gatewood, and Dr. Ray Linda Brown. Dramatic voices were provided by R.T. Jackson, Pat Boykin, Nathan Lewis, Bob Hulsey, and William Wagner, with Donna Creer as Florence Smith Price. Performance of the Symphony in E minor was made possible by the National Women's Composers Resource Center, a project of the Women's Philharmonic in San Francisco, California. Other compositions by Florence Price featured in this program: My Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord, sung by Marian Anderson; Night, sung by Hilda Harris; Althea White on piano performing Cotton Dance and Dances in the Cane Breaks; Dr. Dan Dykema of Magnolia, Arkansas, performing the Piano Sonata in E minor and Bayou Dance; and the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra's Quapaw Quartet performing Negro Folk Songs in Counterpoint. For more information about Florence Price or a cassette copy of this program, contact this station. From Spiritual to Symphony was made possible by a grant from the Arkansas Arts Council. This program was a production of KLRE KUAR in Little Rock.
Thanks for joining us this hour for Gathering the Pieces, the Florence Price Legacy. I'm Karen Trigo Stewart. Let's end the program by listening to Price's Violin Concerto No. 2, featuring Eugene Kong and the Janacek Philharmonic. This is KUAR Little Rock, news and culture for Arkansas.